From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon met with President Bush in Washington today. On the agenda, war with Iraq and the Israeli response. This is the seventh meeting between the two leaders. And in the Oval Office this afternoon, Prime Minister Sharon shook President Bush's hand, saying Israel has never had such cooperation in everything as we have with the current administration. But press conference claims of cooperation cannot hide the fact that behind the scenes the stakes are high and the negotiations critical for Bush and Sharon. Bush wants Sharon to stay out of America's way. Sharon wants to strike back if Saddam takes aim at Israel. Both are preparing for a war in Iraq, a war that will change the strategic landscape of the Middle East for decades to come. This hour, On Point, War on Iraq and the Israeli Factor. We begin tonight with the latest from today's Bush-Sharon meeting. We're joined now by Aluf Ben, diplomatic correspondent for the Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz. Aluf Ben, you're traveling with Prime Minister Sharon on his trip to Washington. What came out of the talks today?
Well, I think the main thing is a more solid American promise to do whatever the United States can to prevent an Iraqi attack on Israel in case the United States is going to attack Iraq.
How much confidence do you think Israel has in the capability of American forces to protect it from some Iraqi attack?
Well, I think Israel has much hope in that better coordination and better preparation would avoid the situation we had in 1991 when Iraq fired 39 Scud missiles at Israel during the Gulf War.
Aluf Ben, you've written very probingly about the dance that's going on inside these talks between President Bush and Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, that each has very important personal and national agendas that may be masked behind the lovely words we saw this afternoon in the Oval Office. From the Israeli perspective first, from Prime Minister Sharon's perspective, what does he need and what does he fear as the United States and Israel approach a potential war with Iraq?
Well, I think the main worry from Sharon and from the Israeli perspective is the Palestinian front. After over 2 years of very violent conflict with the Palestinians and no end in sight, there is a fear in Israel that the Palestinian terror groups and perhaps even the Hezbollah in Lebanon will try to escalate the situation and come up with a new wave of terror attacks during the war with Iraq, believing that Israel's hands would be tied and it won't be able to respond under American pressure. And Sharon is trying to came here, among other things, to create some room to maneuver for himself in case he would want to respond to Palestinian attacks.
And President Bush's comments after their meeting today would have to give pause to Hezbollah or Palestinians, in that he did not say Israel has agreed it will not fight back or push back during a war.
No, what the Americans tried to do is that they wanted to hug Sharon and show friendship and cooperation and support, but on the other hand, they did not want to alienate their Arab and European allies, who are very critical of Sharon, and therefore they tried to focus some attention to the plight of the Palestinian people and extract, even before the visit, some promises from Sharon to do more than Israel did up till now to ease the situation in the West Bank and Gaza. And they know that if there is escalation and new wave of terror attacks, Israel would have to respond, but they asked that this response would be limited to military or to terror targets, and that Israel would avoid any political offensive like it did last month when Yasser Arafat's headquarters was put under siege in Ramallah.
Aluf Ben, you also note that the Israelis are very mindful of the aftermath of the Gulf War, when President Bush's father, having won that war, turned to Israel with a very tough posture on the settlements and the West Bank. You write that Ariel Sharon is concerned that when a war with Iraq ends, that the Bush administration might one day push Israel out of the West Bank and Gaza forever, quote, along with Sharon's beloved life's work, the settlements. What has generated this fear?
Well, I think that Sharon, having served in the Shamir government in 1991, knows very well that the United States has other interests in the Middle East besides its friendship to Israel, as important as it is. And his deepest fear is a kind of deal or secret deal or understanding between America and Saudi Arabia, for instance, for Arab support against Iraq in return for American more activism or more proactive approach towards renewing the peace process. And I think that one of Sharon's main reasons to come here was to have better coordination with Bush and the administration about the morning after and what's going to happen in the Middle East after the removal of Saddam from
power, in Baghdad.
And
You've written, Alif Ben, that Sharon is likely using that. You say he's a master of power politics. He's playing on Bush's fear that Israel will get involved in the Iraqi war and using that fear to extract concessions from the president now,
The deal that Sharon tried to make basically is that Israel stay out of the war with Iraq, and we pave the way for America to Baghdad without our interference or our involvement. But on the other hand, we seek better guarantees from Bush for the day after, so there would not be a sequence of first Saddam and then Sharon. And I think that one of his achievements here was that when the administration finished to write the draft of its roadmap for ending the conflict and renewing the peace process, which should be then coordinated with the Europeans, with the UN, and with the Arab parties, they presented it to Sharon last night, before everyone else, to show that there's nothing there that contradicts the Bush speech or other things that are acceptable by Sharon and by Israel.
But the Bush speech this in June, in addition to saying it was time for Yasser Arafat to go, essentially, also laid out a rough timetable saying that by 2005, the party should be well on their way to a two-state solution, which Sharon, as you have written, resists as a strict timetable.
Well, but the Bush speech did not say it is a rough timetable, but it said it's a vision, and it's dependent on very specific benchmarks for Palestinian reform and for regime change in the Palestinian Authority and for ending terror and violence, and then, and only then, moving towards provisional Palestinian states without final borders, and then to the final steps. And I think this also relates to the personal issues of both leaders, who next year would have to fight for their political lives. Sharon is going to face a very tough challenge of his own party leadership against Benjamin Netanyahu, who approaches a more right-wing and more activist approach towards the Palestinians and even towards Iraq. And if he wins that, he would have to face a general election in the autumn or even before.
So both leaders have their political agendas at work here.
Yeah, and I think that American listeners know about Bush's problems in November and then preparing for 2004 and how Iraq plays into that. And for Sharon, coming here 3 weeks before the election is a very good time because I can't think that Bush would try to alienate Jewish support by leaning on Sharon or putting pressure on Sharon to compromise.
Now, everything was very upbeat today, though you do write, Alif Ben, that some officials in Washington suspect that Sharon wants to use the Iraq war to deliver a coup de grace to the Palestinian Authority while the world's attention is elsewhere and give Israel a better negotiating position on the day after the war or the war ends.
Well, when you make such warnings of imminent terror threats, someone might read it backwards and say that you put out the warning and you cry wolf, wolf in order to use the same preemption doctrine that the Americans use against these threats. And I think that one of the issues that concerned the Americans before the visit was prevent that from happening. And I think that the solution from both sides is emphasizing coordination and consultation and trying to diffuse any suspicions by endlessly coordinating and sending emissaries and passing messages.
Alif Ben, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Alif Ben is diplomatic correspondent for the Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz. He joined us tonight from Washington. We're talking tonight about war on Iraq and the Israel factor. Is Washington prepared to handle the Israel wild card? How should Israel respond if Baghdad bombs Tel Aviv? Could a war in Iraq derail, divert, or redefine the Middle East peace process? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and author of more than 20 books on modern war, including Terrorism, Asymmetric Warfare, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Good evening and welcome, Anthony Cordesman.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight is Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Magazine, monthly magazine. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Anthony Cordesman, take us into this situation where Israel is making very clear noises this time, unlike the Gulf War in 1991, that if it is attacked, Ariel Sharon says it will push back. What are the stakes here, and what are the fears? How likely do you see it that Israel might be attacked, and what kind of shaping of the war could ensue if Israel pushes back and pushes back hard?
Well, a lot depends first on how you perceive the importance of attitudes in the Arab world and the region. And already throughout the Gulf, throughout the Arab world, there is a vast amount of hostility to the United States for its support to Israel. These tensions have grown out of the Second Intifada. It's not an issue of what perceptions are fair, but it's important to understand we're not talking about sort of a standing start with the war, but a very acute problem that already exists.
Washington is surely aware of this. Do you think that that has turned the Oval Office meeting today into a kind of pressure cooker with President Bush behind the scenes saying, please don't push back? Or do they understand why Israel would think that it has to retaliate if it's hit this time?
Well, again, I think there's a very clear message which begins with the idea that we would like to see as much restraint as possible in dealing with the Second Intifada, and particularly during the period building up to war and during the actual conflict. And we have generally dealt with a lot of these issues by very quietly making offers rather than putting pressure on Israel. We point out that obviously it's to Israel's interest to see this dictatorship destroyed, just as it is to the world's. There will probably be quiet discussions of additional military aid, but that really only deals with fairly limited Iraqi attacks. Mm-hmm. If Iraq was to be able to use weapons of mass destruction against Israel, if it did serious damage or Israel had to fear that the next set of attacks could provide catastrophic damage, then frankly the United States would be in a very poor position to try to really persuade Israel to show restraint. But there's one other thing to remember here. If Israel intervenes in the middle of a major U.S. attack on Iraq, with perhaps 400 sorties a day and three or four U.S. and British divisions actually attacking the Iraqi forces, a lot of the impact of anything Israel does is really not going to be very significant or very visible.
So you think it might just be lost in the fray?
Things worse.
Probably would not, you say?
I think the level of hostility in the Arab world and in the region is already so great that, say, 50 Israeli sorties, anything Israel did that didn't produce civilian casualties would certainly get a lot of media attention. But it isn't going to really change fundamentally the attitude of the Arab street or the position of Arab governments.
Jack Beatty, on the other hand, we have heard voices from Israel saying restraint in 1991 in the Gulf War diminished respect for Israel's military prowess, and that if it has to hit back this time, it has to hit back in a way that's seen and heard to be strong.
Yeah, Mr. Cordesman himself made that point in the testimony over the summer before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that in the event of a catastrophic attack on Israel, Israel might even have to declare its nuclear deterrent. But, you know, on the other side, we had an ex-CIA man on our program a couple of weeks ago who'd been out in the Middle East talking to Iraqi officials, and they told him, quote, Saddam wants to bring the Middle East down with him. And that's scary when you think of the implications for Israel, and especially when you think that his command and control over his weapons of mass destruction may even be in the hands of his son, Kezai, who's not exactly a how to put it, a McGovernite.
It is a scary scenario. We're talking tonight about Israel-America on the eve of war with Iraq. Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Israel and America on the eve of war with Iraq, talking about the Israel factor. My guest tonight is Anthony Cordesman. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and former director of intelligence assessment in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. You're welcome to join our conversation as well. What does America need from Israel in the Middle East right now? And what does Israel need from the United States? Is Israel, under the threat of Iraq, the truly wild card in a war with Iraq? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anthony Cordesman, if you'd be good enough, walk us through some of the wartime scenarios that American and Israeli planners must be contemplating right now, perhaps even negotiating about. Take us through the kind of levels of attack and response in terms of depth or severity that we might face here and that we might expect.
Well, at the lowest levels, you might get the equivalent of symbolic attacks. That would be Iraq using some kind of conventional weapons, firing Scud as it did during the last Gulf War, simply to show that it could attack Israel, perhaps trying to provoke Israel, but in ways where Israel would not see sufficient threat to really lash out in large numbers. The problem for Iraq this time is that it may have less than 25 Scuds, and this kind of symbolic attack doesn't seem quite as likely. If that's all it is, I think that for all of the rhetoric in Israel about having to retaliate, they'd think twice, and certainly they might look at U.S. incentives and aid offers and take them seriously.
So are you saying that if the attacks were on the order of the 1991 attacks, where there were, 35, 37 Scuds that came in relatively harmless?
Remember that in those attacks, they certainly weren't totally harmless.
Not totally.
They were from part of a very large Scud force. Now, most of the intelligence estimates put the remaining number of Scud assemblies inside Iraq at some 12 to 25 missiles. So that
not
is
much
the
of an arsenal
of the Gulf War, and that they couldn't use all of them against Israel, and certainly not conventionally.
So, how might Saddam step up from that kind of symbolic potential attack?
Well, the next perhaps option would be to try to provide terrorist groups, Hamas or the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, with chemical or biological weapons. It's certainly possible he can move arms occasionally across through Jordan and through Syria. And that kind of attack would make it harder for Israel to specifically and immediately identify Iraq. And yet, almost any of the act of this kind would give Saddam some kind of status. The problem is it wouldn't alter behavior in the region. It wouldn't change the way Arab states behave. It would be a low-level punishing attack, but it might do more damage to Saddam than good.
How so?
Well, frankly, this kind of demonstration or use of weapons of mass destruction wouldn't do Israel serious damage, but it would basically destroy all of Saddam's credibility and all of the lies that he has told about his weapons of mass destruction would be exposed. But this puts it to the edge of something far more serious.
That being?
The moment you start seeing serious Israeli casualties, at that point it's almost impossible for Israel to show restraint. It can't repeat the kind of limits that it showed or behavior it showed during the Gulf War. It almost has to strike at Iraq and strike very seriously.
How would Israel do that to bring its counterpunch above the fray of the American attack? How might it proceed?
Well, it would have to look very carefully at what the U.S. is attacking, and to be perfectly honest, there aren't that many targets that are likely to be left. The presidential palaces, most key facilities, have to be hit almost immediately because of the risk there are weapons of mass destruction there. So the U.S. would be striking at them from virtually day one, but it would probably pick symbolic targets. If there are remaining palaces, those strike at places like Tikrit, strike at key
Saddam Hussein's hometown
targets like the guards.
Would that be sufficient to fulfill the kind of strategic requirement at that point to remind all neighbors, that you cannot mess with Israel in that way.
Well, I think one has to be very careful. Frankly, the people who say this, that Israel's deterrent is weakened, really don't make a lot of sense. Nobody in the Arab world has drawn that conclusion. Actually, if anything, the feeling was that Israel had immense leverage over the United States. It got lots of aid. The United States rushed missiles in. Israel came out of this a far stronger power. Iraq was basically weakened to the point of being unable to act back then. So Israel's deterrent is one of these rhetorical statements. It wasn't weakened at all. Deterrence is a matter of perceptions.
When and would Israel at any point show that nuclear sword that you referred to in testimony over the summer?
I think the problem is the moment you really escalate, the moment Israel is convinced that, for example, it might face a massive attack, not so much in numbers but lethality, with biological weapons, either on missile warheads or any other source, that its survival was at stake or it might take thousands of casualties, I think it would begin to seriously consider at least some kind of demonstrative strike so devastating that the message would be clear to Iran, to Syria, and every other state that Israel was prepared to use these weapons.
Does that mean a nuclear strike, and what kind of target would be contemplated?
I think a nuclear strike, and perhaps, again, it's only a guess, Israel would escalate probably against a key military target like the Republican Guards, not an Iraqi population center. But if it went further, if it was really a massive killing attack on a town like Tel Aviv or a city like Tel Aviv, then Israel might have no choice other than to retaliate against Iraqi population centers. The message would have to be that any existential threat to Israel would lead to an existential attack
on the offender,
the hostile power.
Jack Beatty, Anthony Cordesman is reminding us to keep our moderate view of this entire stairway of escalation, that it may go no further than symbolic. But once a war begins, a lot is on the table, and one can't be sure what will be on the table and what won't be. There is a lot that could come in play here.
Yes, you know, for decades, the fright about the Middle East, the nuclear fright, was that the fuses of the alliance systems led on the one hand to Moscow and on the other hand to Washington. And in 1973, our forces even went on nuclear alert over precisely that kind of fusing, with Moscow standing up and we standing up and so on. And so that fear sort of went away with the Cold War, but here we see it now with weapons of mass destruction and with the possibility that, Saddam was deterred from using those weapons in 1990 and 91 against Israel and against us because we had biological weapons and chemical weapons too. He was deterred. But if the goal of the war is to destroy him, what incentive does he have other than the sort of Gotterdammerung?
Let it all loose.
Yeah. That's what's, I think, most frightening here.
Anthony Cordesman, do you agree that there's sort of kind of a temptation to open the floodgates if Saddam feels that he's got it all on the line?
There certainly is. I think you would find in the intelligence community, however, virtually every possible interpretation of his motives, from the fact he would be too frightened to the fact he would preempt, try to strike out at either U.S. bases or Israel before the war even begins, to try to catalyze the situation before he's at risk. But let me make an important qualification here.
Please.
We don't know that Saddam really has the ability to attack at this point in time with great lethality. VX is a very dangerous gas, but it takes a lot of it to do serious damage. And we don't know if he has anything approaching an effective warhead. All of the biological agents he had at the time of the Gulf War were what we call wet agents. They're extremely hard to disseminate. Again, it takes much more bulk than modern biological weapons. And he had no modern warheads, no modern bombs to actually deliver them.
So the mercy would be if there were actually no means to deliver, even if he would like to.
I think he can certainly deliver some chemical or biological weapons, and Israel might be faced with a horrible choice of looking at an ineffective device, but one the next time might be lethal. But that, again, is a possible argument for going to war now, because he is virtually certain in the years to come to get either nuclear weapons or dry storable biological weapons or more sophisticated warheads. If we're right, he doesn't really have the capability to seriously threaten Israel's existence or even that of U.S. forces.
At this point.
There's one other thing we should remember, too. Mm-hmm. In the Gulf War, we had patriots with a very crude computer algorithm rushed into deployment that couldn't distinguish between the warhead and the missile body. The Patriot today is a far more sophisticated system, and Israel also has the arrow. Mm-hmm. So Saddam faces a very serious missile defense, not only in Israel, but in Kuwait, and even in Saudi Arabia. And while it's a point defense, it's something Saddam can't disregard in any way, shape, or form.
Anthony Cordesman, Jack Beatty, stand by. We have callers who want to join us. Let's invite them in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Nelson's calling from Boston. Hi, Nelson. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you.
Being no expert in policy analysis, the only thing I can really say is that I don't think that we can reasonably expect Israel to restrain from retaliating if they're hit again, assuming, of course, that Saddam does have the capabilities that the U.S. and British intelligence assessments have garnered over the years, and if your callers are correct, assuming that his capabilities are up to snuff, that perhaps the air defense artillery systems that your guest just mentioned, are ineffective to some degree.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying if they're hit, they've got to be able to hit back. Anthony Cordesman, I want to take that and put it to you in terms of likely Arab response. Of course, in the Gulf War, President Bush, one, said we can't have Israel hitting back because our Arab coalition will fall apart. What might the cost be during war this time out?
This was not a war involving an Arab coalition in terms of lots of Arab forces, but it is a coalition where we must have small Arab states in the Gulf to use for basing, and where, again, the overall reaction in the Arab world is already extremely hostile to the U.S. because of the Second Intifada. It may well be that a critical government, whether it would be Bahrain or Qatar, might not be able to sustain its support for the United States if Israel lashed out in a massive way. But again, you have to remember that since the level of anger in the street is already this high, a carefully focused Israeli strike, one that didn't attack civilians but the centers of Saddam's power, might not change Arab perceptions all that much. And Israel is a very sophisticated military power, and it isn't going to use force randomly or simply to make a statement without remembering the fact that its real interest here is not to demonstrate it will attack, but to see Iraq destroyed and Saddam removed from power.
Anthony Cordesman, we've seen other reports in the press in the last few weeks that catch our attention. Jordan saying that in the event of war, it would guard its borders against an influx of Palestinians, presumably from the West Bank. Discussion of Israel warning Hezbollah to be careful, and an interpretation of that Israel might go into Lebanon to deal with Hezbollah while war was going on with Iraq. Beyond the simple tit-for-tat, as awful as that might be, do you see other events that war might tip into action here, whether somehow Palestinian populations being pushed toward Jordan or Israeli power being thrust into Lebanon?
Well, there are all kinds of conspiracy theories. One is that Israel would use this opportunity to drive the Palestinians out of the West Bank and into Jordan. Another is that it will broaden the war, use this as sort of the inattention to suddenly strike at Lebanon and strike at Hezbollah there, or that it will somehow remove Arafat from power in the middle of all of this.
Do any of these strike you as credible?
Frankly, no. Mm-hmm. I think that Israel, again, and certainly Ariel Sharon and the people around him, know this region very well. If what they want to do is to act decisively, the time to do it is not at the worst moment in terms of Israel's other objective, which is seeing Iraq removed as a military threat. Mm-hmm. And sort of to try to use this war, knowing all of these risks as they do, to carry out an action which they would not carry out in peacetime is not really credible. It's much more sort of the standard conspiracy theory approach to the Middle East that's so common in the region than something that's strategically probable.
Mm-hmm. David's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening. Mr. Cordesman already answered in some ways my question, which was whether he didn't think Saddam Hussein would preempt an American attack if he saw it coming by attacking Israel. But perhaps he can also tell us what other ways that Saddam may use to try and broaden this into a more a wider Arab-Israeli war. Would he possibly move his command and control out of Iraq into Jordan or some other part of the Middle East?
So is there some other way other than an attack on Israel? David, thanks for your call. Anthony Cordesman, how about it? Does Saddam Hussein have other levers within reach to broaden this war?
Well, one possible way is to strike at U.S. buildup points, ports or facilities in Kuwait or elsewhere in the Gulf, to basically send the message to the southern Gulf states that he can strike and use weapons of mass destruction in spite of American power and potentially threaten the civilian population centers in these countries. Another possibility that people have raised is that he could strike at some critical oil facility, perhaps one of the key Saudi ports or one of the major shipping areas, or even a desalination plant. The problem with all of these scenarios are that they assume that he has the capability to sustain such an operation, that such a strike would actually intimidate countries in the southern Gulf and the United States rather than provoke them.
Mm-hmm.
So he might miscalculate, but these are much less attractive options in reality than they might seem before you think out the history of America.
Jack Beatty, Anthony Cordesman describes an Israel with its eyes pretty much fixed on the prize here, and the prize being a Iraq demilitarized and defanged of Saddam Hussein.
Yes, and this gets back to the hopes of the administration in this. I was talking to someone who knows people in the administration, and he said that their furthest hope is that somehow by removing Saddam, that things will be, quote, shaken up. The status quo will be shaken up in the Middle East. The dice will be thrown again in such a way that will help produce peace. In short, that the path to peace in Jerusalem lies through Baghdad. What do you think of that, Mr. Cordesman?
Well, it's, to me, a fantasy. You have some neoconservatives who believe it. First, I think it's going to take years to create a stable Iraq, and I have not even heard what the administration's plan is to have peacemaking and to create that kind of stable government and country.
Anthony Cordesman, we'll hold that thought. We're going to come back to it right after a short break. We're talking tonight about Israel and America on the eve of war with Iraq. What should George Bush be telling Ariel Sharon? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Israel and America on the eve of war with Iraq. War could still be averted, but plans are well underway, and we're talking about the Israel factor, if and when that war comes to pass. You can join us. How much restraint can Washington rightly ask of Israel? What are the limits? And could the war push Israel to go public with its nuclear arms? Should Washington agree not to demand Israeli concessions on the West Bank later to get its promise of restraint now? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Anthony Cordesman, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington and former director of intelligence assessment in the office of the Secretary of Defense. John's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was wondering, might it be possible to not actually have to launch missiles into Israel?
John, you're breaking up. I'm sorry. We'll try and get you on a better line. Let's turn to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where Joe is calling. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call. I guess my first question is, to what degree are our problems with Saddam Hussein and the Arab world linked to our support of Israel? And I guess I'm a neutral person calling from the Midwest, sort of a simpleton at heart.
we don't buy that, Joe. But
I can't understand. No one has ever given me, and I have yet to read, a clear-cut policy of our position with respect to Israel. Why we have that position in spite of all the situation that Israel has been involved in, which I patently disagree with. It seems we're in bed with Israel, and it's causing us a lot of problems. Certainly, it's strategically in our interest to have a good relationship with them for oil fields and for a stable position, a stable democracy in the Middle East. But why are we there, and why are we continuing to work with these crazy regimes, these crazy people, who I think are just as much our friends as causing us all kinds of problems?
Joe, let's take that to Anthony Cordesman. And Mr. Cordesman, I guess the heart of this is Joe would like a review of the strategic balance here of U.S. interest in Israel and U.S. interest in the region at large. I mean, in a nutshell, how do you answer that?
Israel is basically a moral commitment, and I think we need to understand the history here.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a sort of small country in the Middle East. It is a group of people who are the victims of the Holocaust. And yes, it is not something you can tie to oil or to trade or some kind of economic benefits. And if that's your only criteria, then the American commitment to Israel simply doesn't make any sense. I doubt for most of Americans that's the case. It is true that often for a whole variety of domestic political reasons, our support of Israel turns into a tilt, almost a competition, to support Israeli positions, which often have little to do with Israel's strategic interest and a great deal to do with domestic politics. I'm not sure how much we can blame Israel for the fact that as we go into a war, the Congress suddenly decided to pass legislation encouraging a sudden move of the capital to Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of American political action, again, perhaps we have to blame on ourselves. But when we talk about the Gulf, a couple of points need to be kept in mind. Some of the countries that we are talking about and often get attacked in the American press, like Saudi Arabia, have been allies of the United States since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
They fought against bin Laden long before we did. And strategically, why are we there? Well, in 1973, when the oil embargo began, we estimated that about 53% of the world's proven oil reserves were in the Gulf. After 30 years of trying to find oil reserves somewhere else, we now have raised the estimate to 65%.
More important than ever.
And there is absolutely no prospect that we're not going to become more dependent, and our global economy isn't going to become more dependent on this. For all the talk of the Bush energy policy, it basically calls for something like a 70% increase in U.S. import.
So you've written, Anthony Cordesman, the United States now risks turning this war into a true clash of civilizations. I guess how can we minimize that risk? And in the context of our conversation tonight, how can Israel help to minimize that risk?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of Israel ever sacrificing its national interests, but I think sometimes it really is a matter of a true Israeli commitment to peace, and that means on Israeli terms, security, not accepting some kind of false peace.
Mm-hmm.
It does mean showing restraint when restraint is really needed, sometimes at cost, at least temporary cost politically or tactically. I think that really, more than anything else, is what we need to see from Israel, and I really think here perhaps Prime Minister Sharon does not come close to the level of understanding that Rabin or Barak showed.
Should President Bush be putting pressure on for some kind of commitment to the withdrawal of settlements that many people have talked about from the West Bank post a war, after a war?
I think that we could be more visible on this, but if we do this, we have to be a lot more visible on security. It isn't mm-hmm. a matter of tilting away from Israel. It's mm-hmm. a matter of making a very visible, open commitment to pushing the peace process, not sort of episodic meetings of the Big Four or sending General Zinni for brief trips.
Mm-hmm. But really being committed both to Israel's security and to peace.
And I think that, in many ways, is the most serious criticism of those Arabs who understand this in the Gulf and elsewhere, that the United States simply hasn't shown the commitment and visibility. The other criticism, and I think perhaps it is a fair one, is that while much of the American reaction to Islamic extremism is justified, there has been an almost anti-Islamic, anti-Muslim, anti-Arab tone to a great deal of what has been said in the United States, particularly in the media. And while President Bush has tried to discourage this, it is certainly true that if you look at America as a country and what is said in the media and elsewhere, there is an almost continuous trashing of the Arab world and indeed of Islam.
That's a tall wall. Anthony Cordesman, our time has run down, but we thank you for joining us tonight. It's been very illuminating. Thanks so much for coming on Point.
Thank you.
Anthony Cordesman is senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's former director of intelligence assessment in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and he's author, among other books, of Terrorism, Asymmetric Warfare, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Jack Beatty, it's a complex scenario that Anthony Cordesman describes here that our callers poke at. Bush needs Sharon, Sharon needs Bush, and at some point, everybody needs peace out there.
Yeah, at some point. It's just hard to see where the dynamics are that lead to peace. And I thought his comment that the hopes that somehow the road to peace in Jerusalem lay through Baghdad, I thought his comment that that was something of a fantasy is worth pondering, especially since one can't see any direct connection, and especially as the Intifada has already sufficiently poisoned views of America in that area that it's hard to imagine. It's just hard to imagine how this could do anything other than make things worse on that front.
Well, we may see and know soon enough. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a look at life in the West Bank city of Hebron. This is On Point. Israeli Defense Minister Benjamin Ben-Eliezer will hold meetings tomorrow to discuss the possibility of withdrawing Israeli forces from parts of the city of Hebron that were formerly under Palestinian control. Hebron has been under a series of tight curfews over the past several months, including a new one imposed last week after four Jewish settlers were shot there. Nahani Rouse, an independent producer from the United States studying in Jerusalem, was in Hebron the day of those shootings. In this radio diary, she chronicles a day which for her seemed filled with violence and anger, but which for most Israelis and Palestinians seemed like any other day.
The original objective of my trip to Hebron is to interview Palestinians about how they're coping with a series of curfews over the past few months. My guide and translator is Majdi Dana, a native of Hebron who is also a U.S. citizen. Our first stop is the Tomb of Abraham, which is claimed by both Muslim and Jewish residents. Outside the Mosque of Abraham, a group of Palestinians, young men and some boys, cluster around two Israeli soldiers. One Palestinian man is arguing with an officer of the border police.
The officer says, "You see something," and the soldier says something else. Your brother will tell the investigator what happened, and the soldier will tell his story, and the justice will prevail.
We move into a nearby convenience store. Some of the men follow us. Isaac Kofisha, the proprietor, is sitting at a table with a cash register. He says about an hour ago he saw the brothers fighting with the border police in front of his store. One of the men gathered around says the fight originally started when a group of Jewish settlers threw rocks at a school nearby and overturned tables at a store owned by a man named Abdel. Isaac says he heard news a few hours ago that four settlers were shot on a road south of Hebron this morning. One will later die of his injuries.
First of all, when they heard about the incident outside Hebron where four settlers were shot, the settlers were angry and they attacked the stores in the area here and the people in the street also.
We leave Isaac's store and walk down the street toward Abdel's store. There are large armored vehicles driving around. A neighbor bangs on the door to the stall, calling for Abdel's son to open up. Abdel Raouf opens the door smiling. He appears to be in good spirits.
I was here at 12:30 doing coffee inside, and the slavs came. I know they just came out to the stand outside, and they dumped all the goods on the street, and they started stomping on it, and then they attacked our neighbor here and destroyed all the argilas he is selling.
There is no mess to be seen now. All of Abdel's merchandise is packed in sacks at the back of his stall.
Then the police came and they took our affidavit. We told them what happened, and now they're coming again. But it looks like they don't believe what we said first, and this will lead to nowhere. I envy a dog for his life, you know.
Abdel invites us in for coffee. We climb stone stairs to Abdel's apartment. The ceilings are high and the rooms are large. Abdel shows us to the living room. 12-year-old Mohammed brings us glasses of coffee his sisters have prepared.
In the mornings, curfew. You go to, you just open your eyes, you want to live, and it's curfew. The kids cannot go home, they stuck home, bombing all the time and shooting everywhere. That's the kind of life we lived in the last few months.
Nobody has money anymore, Abdel says. He pulls a piece of paper out of his pocket. It's a handwritten list of the debtors who owe him money. His store used to bring in 700 shekels a day. Now he sometimes makes only 15. Before we leave, I go into a separate room to meet Abdel's wife, Nedia, and his daughters, Sahar and Isri. Majdi stays in the living room and explains that it isn't proper for them to come out while he is there. Sahar is shyly telling me that maybe she speaks English when we hear gunshots and Majdi calls to me that we need to go. Abdel shows us back down to the street. Majdi assures me that gunshots in late afternoon are common here. He says that is how the army announces a curfew. A spokesman for the army will later tell me that the shots were fired in warning to break up Palestinians and settlers who were rioting elsewhere in the city. Jeeps and armored cars are beginning to move around as we go back past the Mosque of Abraham. Isak waves to us as he closes up his store. A bulldozer is maneuvering a cement block to partially cover the passageway to the old city, and a soldier motions us to hurry up and go through.
Yeah, we're going.
About a dozen more soldiers are standing in the entrance, eyeing us as we go past.
It's tense. Hebron is tense. It's a very tense city, you know. As they say in the United States, you can even cut it with a knife, the tension here.
Majdi pauses to ask a group of teenagers if they know where the shooting is coming from.
Told me we don't know yet, but we are keeping our ears open to see, to know where it is, you know, so we know what will happen, you know.
The market is emptying. Shopkeepers are packing produce into crates and closing the shutters on their stores. 5 or 6 tanks drive by. People are scurrying, Majdi says, because the curfew is most strictly enforced here in the city center.
I totally understand why it's not normal for you, you know? To hear shooting, to hear bombardment, to see a tank in the street while you are shopping. If this is becoming normal, we are in a very unfortunate situation.
So it doesn't even scare you to hear it?
No, not scared, no. It scares you only when you feel it's very close to you, blah, blah, blah. But it makes you cautious. Mm-hmm. That's all, you know. People stopped having extreme feelings about things. Unfortunately, killing people became normal here. It's becoming a normal thing. It's a very, very unfortunate thing, even for us.
We hear more gunfire and people start to move faster. Some of the women are running. We find a van going to Jerusalem, and I climb in among large bags of clothes. I look out the window and watch the sun set over the city. I am struck by how routine the fighting and the gunshots and the curfew seem to be here. An Israeli army spokesman will later tell me that the curfew was imposed so the army could search for the terrorist who shot the settlers this morning and prevent further attacks. The army makes a direct connection between the lifting of curfews and the ability of terrorists to carry out attacks. Palestinians I spoke with today experienced the curfews as collective punishment.
Nahani Raus is an independent producer from the United States studying in Jerusalem. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.